offering my most humble pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. Dear listeners, I welcome you to this week's episode of the Gita series, A Triune Pilgrimage. This is Prem, your friend from Team Radio Sai, and as always, it is my pleasure to meet you all live from our studios at Prashantanilam, the Shri Satya Sai Media Center. For those of you who have been following this series regularly, it's a program where we go through the Bhagavad Gita verse by verse. We go through simultaneously Swami's Gita Vahini, and it's been a wonderful journey from my end. I do hope that some of you are equally enjoying this program, because it not only is an opportunity to go through one of the most sacred texts, but it is also an opportunity to look at ourselves and review our journey and see what we are doing right so we can do more of that, and what we are not doing not so right so that we can correct ourselves. I think this is what the opportunity we've been presented with in the form of this Gita series. We've completed 8 chapters, and it has been a practice that we have a summary at the end of the completion of a chapter. We've been doing that since the second chapter. I think the only chapter for which I did not do a summary was the first one, because the real discourse starts from the second chapter, so didn't really do a summary for the first one. So, keeping up with the tradition, let's have a summary for the 8th chapter too. This 8th chapter is referred to as Akshara Parabrahma Yoga, or sometimes even as Akshara Brahma Yoga. But we thought we will stick to the Akshara Parabrahma Yoga, because that is the name that Swami uses in Gita Vahini. The meaning of that name is, it is a study of the indestructible Brahman. Akshara, indestructible, Parabrahman means the supreme being. Swami explains beautifully in the Gita Vahini the context behind this chapter. The chapter begins with Arjuna asking about a few statements or phrases that Krishna had used very casually towards the end of the previous chapter. To be more specific, Krishna had used the words Adhibhuta, Adhiyajna, Adhyatma and Adhidaiva. Apart from these 4, he also speaks of knowing Brahman and knowing karma in its entirety. Swami explained as a prelude to this chapter that man is led to God by the desire to overcome grief. If you recall, when we were speaking about the 4 kinds of devotees, the Artha, Arthati, Jignasu, Swami had said there that this journey that turns towards God happens because of man's grief and the desire to overcome grief. And that is captured in the statement Jara Marana Mokshaya that Krishna makes in the end of the previous chapter. He says, the desire to overcome Jara, old age, and Marana is what leads one to God. And Jara and Marana are symbolic, which means one does not want status quo to change, and one does not want that which is good to end. So that is what it represents, Jara and Marana. This leads one to seek God. But then Krishna says, Swami says in Krishna's words, that without overcoming grief, one cannot attain God. Swami says that at this point Arjuna is surprised, because he asks, this seems kind of unfair. One turns to God because there are troubles and one wants to overcome grief. And here Krishna is saying that you must overcome grief so that you can attain God. So Swami explains that grief cannot be removed even by God. Grief can be removed only by knowledge, by jnana. Swami writes in the Gita Vahini that to remove darkness, light is needed. You cannot frighten darkness away or make it yield by prayer or petition or protest. Those are Swami's words. Unless there is light, darkness will not disappear, howsoever you may try. Similarly, for ignorance to go, knowledge has to come. And this is the backdrop of this entire chapter. in this chapter, Krishna grants that understanding of that Brahman who is Akshara or indestructible. Of course, he doesn't stop there, but also goes on to explain the impact of this knowledge on the Jivatma or the individual. So let us start with beginning, at the beginning of the chapter. So as I said, it starts with Arjuna raising some questions. Arjuna asking Krishna to explain the words that he had made a mention of. Arjuna asks, what is that Brahman? What is that Adhyatma? What is Karma, O Purushottama? What is stated to be Adibhuta? And what is called Adidaiva? In the next verse, he continues his questioning. He says, who is this Adiyajna? And the question is more specific. He says, Adiyajna katham kaha atra dehe asmin Madhusudana. Who and how is that which is referred to as Adiyajna to be recognized in this body, O Madhusudana Krishna? This question gives us a hint that Arjuna is actually aware of these terms, right? It's not that he's completely, ignorant about some of these usages, but he is curious to know in what context Krishna is using them or what Krishna means when he uses these phrases. So he seems to know what Adiyajna is, but what in the human body is referred to as Adiyajna, he wants to know. So that question gives us that hint. And because Arjuna knows, Krishna's answers are very straightforward and in fact extremely crisp. Since we do not know these words, we need to unpack all of these words through the references of the scriptures and then understand what Krishna means by using these terms in this particular chapter of the or the previous chapter in the Gita. Another point that Krishna made in the previous chapter that got Arjuna thinking is also raised by him here. Arjuna asks, you said that in the last moments also the jnani knows these things. How is that possible? Is it really possible to hold on to this knowledge or for that matter any kind of knowledge at that final moment of death? Will we have control over our thoughts in those last moments of our life? As a warrior, Arjuna asks this important question because when you go into the war, you are not too sure when that moment is going to come. It is not like anybody who is living the full life and at the end of old age can prepare for those last moments. So that last moment can come at any time. So Arjuna is asking, is it really possible to have control over the thoughts in those last moments? So these are the doubts that are bothering Arjuna and these are the doubts that get addressed beautifully in this chapter by Krishna. So the discourse in this chapter starts with the third verse and what Krishna is saying here also has a historical context like many other verses in this chapter and other chapters of the Gita as well. Here Krishna is clarifying the supreme truth in a sense because as I said that is the context of this chapter. And in the process, he is also clarifying some of the concepts spoken of in other scriptures and other schools of Vedanta. There are various schools of thought that take different stances on some of these topics. And Krishna is making clear which one of those have got it right, so to say. The first statement that he makes is, Aksharam Brahma Paramam. The Brahman is Aksharam. Aksharam is that which cannot be broken down any further, indestructible. But Aksharam means the last unit of anything, right? Because we use the word Aksharam also for a letter. A letter or an alphabet is the last unit of a spoken sentence, right? In the same way, Aksharam means that which cannot be broken down any further, that which is indestructible. But he doesn't stop there. He adds an adjective, Paramam, which means supreme. There are many objects that are comparatively Aksharam. You can break all pots that are of different sizes and shapes and reduce all of them to clay. So clay is Aksharam in relationship to the pot. But even this clay can be further broken down to the elemental forms, atoms, subatoms, and so on and so forth. But Brahman is Aksharam Paramam. It is the supreme and final indestructible entity. And that is why that adjective is added. Krishna doesn't stop there. He says, Aksharam Brahma Paramam Swabhavah Adhyatmam Uchyate. That supreme indestructible, which is called Brahman, is that which is spoken of as the Adhyatma. In general parlance, what is this Adhyatma? As I said, Arjuna had some basic idea of these terms, but since we don't, we will have to look at the actual meaning of those also and the interpretation that Krishna is giving. When I start this inquiry as to who am I, this process is like peeling an onion layer by layer and reaching the core. I'm sitting in this broadcast room of the studio. When someone asks me, who are you? I will not say, I am this room, or I am the studio, or I won't say, I am Radio Sai. I am only seated here in this facility, in this room, in this hall, for a brief time. In the same manner, when somebody asks me, who am I? If I say, I am this body, then it is like me saying, I am this room. I am only staying in this body, which is like a container, for a brief time. Our self is something deeper than this physical entity. So Adhyatma is that true self in each entity that is obtained by negating or peeling off everything that is only merely a layer or a container. So in that sense, when I start this process of finding out who I am, I have an Adhyatma. I don't know what it is. I don't know whether it is divine. I don't know whether it is one with Brahman. I am not sure whether it has an individual existence of its own. I only am referring to it as Adhyatma, my true inner self. So in that sense, everyone has an Adhyatma. Everyone has the true inner self that can be referred to as Adhyatma, the real you. And so it is not only with human beings, it is so with plants, animals, individuals, bees, all kinds of entities, right? So every entity has an Adhyatma. In the beginning of the previous chapter, we had seen that the Supreme has two components, Para Prakriti, Apara Prakriti. Para means Supreme, Apara means that which is immediate, that which is within our experience. Para Prakriti is the unmanifest Supreme. And Apara is the apparent creation, the creation that we interact with. This Para Prakriti is also referred to as Swabhava. And Apara was referred to as Swarupa of the Lord. The Swarupa or the form is the manifest. Swabhava is the unmanifest nature with its divine quality intact, if I could put it that way. So in this statement, Krishna says, the Swabhava of that Brahman and the Adhyatmam are one and the same. The supreme nature of Brahman, which is called Swabhava, is what is the Adhyatma in every entity. So this is a very important declaration that Krishna makes, that the Atma within is the same as that indestructible Brahman. Aksharam Paramam Brahmam. We had discussed this in detail by going through the concept of Asti, Bhati and Priyam being the same as the Satchit Ananda aspect of Brahman. And this we did based on Swami's explanation in the Gita Vahini. To briefly summarize that, every individual is described by five words. They are made up of these five entities according to Vedanta. The verse that speaks of this goes, Asti Bhati Priyam Rupam Nama Chetyamsha Panchakam Adhyatrayam Brahma Rupam Jagat Rupam Tato Dvayam. Asti Bhati Priyam Rupam Nama are the five amshas or qualities of all things and beings. The first three, Adhyatrayam, that is Asti Bhati and Priyam, are divine qualities. Jagad Rupam Tato Dvayam. The other two, Rupa and Nama, which are changing, are attributes of this Jagat, the ephemeral, ever-changing world. Swami explained that Brahman is described by these attributes, Sat, Chit, Ananda, and when you look at it closely, these Asti is, this what is referred to as Asti is Sat, Bhati is Chit, Priyam is Ananda. Sat manifests in our life as our innate desire to live endlessly, Swami had said. The Atma is eternal, but because we have this false identification with the body, we think that we are the body, we are this personality. So we try to superimpose this idea of immortality over these entities, right? That is why there is always a desire to extend life. There is always a desire to stay ever youthful and energetic, right? So Swami says that is actually a manifestation of Sat, which is in the form of Asti in all beings. Similarly, when we refer to Chit, which is the same as Bhati. Bhati, the word as such means effulgence. Chit means intelligence. So Swami says the supreme intelligence expresses itself in our life as the thirst for knowledge that makes us seek answers and questions and deeper inquiry. All of that is an expression of this Chit aspect within us. Similarly, Ananda, which is supreme bliss, in Brahman expresses itself as a desire and craving to remain happy all the time. So Swami concluded that explanation by saying that these three qualities, Asti, Bhati and Priyam, are the core reality of every being, and these are the Swabhava of Brahman, and these alone are Adhyatma, the true nature of each one of us. Then Krishna explains about karma by saying, Bhuta Bhavod Bhavakaraha Visargaha. That sacrifice which causes the origin and growth of beings, Karma Sanyitaha, is called action or karma. So Krishna is stating that everything that involves sustenance of beings is referred to as karma. And that is also what has led to birth itself. So birth, sustenance and growth of all beings is accomplished through what is referred to as karma. But then Swami explained the true inner meaning of this statement, because as I said, Krishna makes it in a very cryptic manner or in a very straightforward manner. Also because Arjuna is fairly knowledgeable in these matters, but thanks to Swami's Gita Vahini, Swami explains this to us in a manner that is intelligible even to people like us. So Swami had explained that the true inner meaning of this statement is that which led to the coming to existence of this entire universe also must be referred to as karma, because that which causes birth, sustenance and growth and eventually even destruction is referred to as karma. So if you look at it, this entire creation is a karma of the Lord, right? So when you look at it that way, the divine sankalpa that let there be creation, Swami says, is the primordial karma. Every karma thereafter has been born only of this primordial karma, which is the divine sankalpa or the divine will. So just like how Adhyatma is divine, when we look deep, even karma in its essence is of divine origin, right? That's one of the most important things that Krishna has been trying to establish through these various chapters. So he makes that point again here too. In the fourth shloka, Krishna speaks about Adhibhuta and Adhidaiva. He says, Adhibhutam Ksharobhavaha. What is referred to as Adhibhutam is nothing but my perishable nature. After having said Brahman is Aksharam, here Krishna says that all beings that come and go are part of my Ksharobhavaha, perishable nature. What is this Adhibhuta in regular parlance? Adhibhuta is the elemental building block of this creation. The five elements are referred to as panchabhutas, right? So adibhuta is a reference to these elements, and Krishna states that these are also divine, just like how adhyatma is divine. This seems like a contradiction to Krishna, to Arjuna, because Krishna said paramam aksharam is Brahman, and here he is saying that which is perishable in nature is also Brahman. Then when we went through Swami's clarification for this statement, we could understand this better, where Swami explains the food that constitutes all beings, even this physical body which is perishable by nature, which is not eternal like the spirit, even this body is made out of food. The food comes from the five elements. The five elements has its origin in Maya, or the primordial delusion which God created. And this Maya came from the Lord. And this separation of the Lord and Maya itself is an illusion, right? That is the primary basis of this entire path of Advaita itself. So when you look at it that way, there is no separation between God and the five elements, God and the food that we eat, God and this body. So in such a beautiful way, Swami explains how the Lord is also the perishable aspect, the Kshara-bhavaha of adibhuta. A similar explanation is extended to the concept of adidaiva too. He says, purushaha cha adidaivatam. And the adidaivata is also purusha. What is the general idea of adidaiva? Just like how some schools of philosophy speak of adhyatma as the core of earthly beings, they speak of adhidaiva as the core of certain celestial forces. So behind the sun, we probably say a sun god or Suryadeva. That is an adhidaiva. Behind fire, we have an Agnideva. Similarly, we speak of many smaller deities, Vanadevatas, village deities, and many such divine beings are spoken of. So Krishna says the adidaiva behind all these celestial entities is also the same Purusha. And Swami says that this Purusha is existent in all beings as the Hiranyagarbha principle, the unmanifest potency. And the relationship between the adidaiva and this Hiranyagarbha is similar to the relationship between the senses and the individual. How's that? Just like how I interact with the world through my senses, the Purusha interacts with creation through these adidaivas. Right? That is the example that Swami gave. And the question, and for the question about adhiyagnya, Krishna states, adhiyagnyah aham eva atra dehe. O Arjuna, I alone am the adhiyagnya here in the body. Adhiyagnya is the receiver of all offerings in a yagnya. And this declaration is very similar to what Krishna made in the Brahmarpanam shloka, right? In that entire portion where Krishna speaks about yagnya, he says a jnani is one who understands that whatever offering is made, it reaches the same Purusha, and the person who is making the offering is also the same Purusha. So adiyagnya is that entity which is the innermost force in a yagna, which accepts whatever is being offered. And then the same thing is spoken of in terms of food. We saw how the person who is receiving the food and the nourishment is the same adiyagnya. And it is with that nourishment that we further gather food and further offer. So the one who is receiving and the one who is giving is the same entity. So the import of this statement is, Krishna is stating that he alone is the doer and the enjoyer, the kartritva and the karta and the bhokta, the one who does and the one who enjoys. From the fifth shloka starts the important discussion about the significance of the last moments of one's life. The rest of the chapter is going to revolve around this. Krishna says, whoever thinks of me in the last moments, that person reaches me. And he very emphatically declares, na asti atra samshayaha. There is no doubt about this. This is not a gamble. There are no loopholes in this. There are no chances in this. If you think of me in the last moments, it will happen. This is satyam. This is the truth. That's why he says, na asti atra samshayaha. And this is a statement that he repeats later in the chapter 2 with regard to this point. He says, there is no doubt about this. We then discussed what Swami says about this. One is, the way we live life matters, for that is what decides our last thoughts. And the other point that Swami made is, the necessity to be prepared, the necessity to be ever prepared for that moment is very critical, because no one knows when it may come. Best example for that are the warriors who have come to participate in the war. There is no guarantee that they will see the end of the day when they participate in the war. So you never know when that moment will come. This very moment could be the last moment. So when to start preparing for that? Right now. The present is the only option that we have. Not only this, whatever you think of in the last moments, Krishna says, it is that you will attain. So after having said that if you think of me, you will attain me, Krishna also makes the other point that whatever you think of in the last moments, you will attain that, because what you think of in the last moments is what you have been thinking of all through your life. Swami says in the Gita Vahini that spiritual aspirants must be always aware of this point. These two points, what you think of is what is going to decide your journey after this life. Swami had said there, the yearning for a spiritual aspirant must be slowly directed towards from how to be born towards how to die. Because thinking of or aspiring for anything else will only lead to another birth. Maybe with the same passions or with those passions fulfilled. If I have been craving to be a musician, maybe I'll be born as a musician, or I will be born with the same interest, right? So what I dwell on in this life will decide the flavor of my next birth. So whether we know it or not, whether we are trying for it or not, we all are already preparing for our next birth. So that's why Swami says the only way to ensure that that doesn't happen is to focus on how to die rather than how to be born again. So Swami says the spiritual aspirants should direct their efforts from how to be born to how to die. Krishna then speaks about what will lead to further births, and he's going to explain about that. There are many options that are present in front of the individual. What happens when each of those options are selected? In the 7th verse, Krishna makes a very important statement, a statement that is oft quoted by Swami in his discourses. Having said you reach what you think of in the last moments, and you think of in the last moments what you have been aspiring for all through your life, Krishna says, Tasmat sarva kaleshu mam anusmara yudhyacha. Therefore, sarva kaleshu, at all times, during all circumstances, during all situations, mam anusmara yudhyacha, remembering me, continue to fight. We also made it very clear that this Krishna is not telling each one of us to go and fight. It doesn't mean go and fight with your wife, go and fight with your boss, go and fight with your neighbors. Yudhyacha is a reference to the struggles of life. Whatever be the course that we have taken, whatever be the duty we have taken upon ourselves, that involves a certain amount of struggle, that involves a certain amount of effort. So Krishna says, Sarveshu Kaleshu, at all times, thinking of me, Ma Manusmara, constantly, without break, thinking of me, Yudhyacha. Continue with your struggle of your chosen or your mandated duty. So constantly having the mind fixed on Lord, this has to be, life has to be gone through is what Krishna says. But how do we practically achieve this? How does one ensure that the mind is fixed on the Lord, and is it practically possible? In the very next statement, in the next line of the same shloka, Krishna says, Mai arpitam mano buddhihi, offering to me your mind and intellect. Thinking of God is not a task. Mam anusmare yudhyachai is not an instruction to multitask. Thinking of God is a task. Doing your duty is a task. If you look at it that way, then this question arises, how can I do both simultaneously? Anusmarana is like the banks of a river that guide this river to its destination. That's why Krishna says, arpitam mam anusmara, arpitam mano buddhihi. Whatever you do, whatever you take up, do it as an offering to me. Do it as something that will eventually lead you to me. Do it as something that you are eventually trying to please me with. That will lead to anusmarana, constant, unbroken contemplation of the Lord. In the next shloka, Krishna explains how this is possible through abhyasa. He says, abhyasa yoga yuktena chetasa. A mind that has been made steadfast through abhyasa yoga, this can be achieved. So in the same way we meditate, when we spoke about dhyana yoga, when Krishna explained what is abhyasa, the mind has this tendency of going away, the mind has the tendency of going astray. And so the abhyasa is nothing but constantly bringing back the mind into track. So in the same way, constantly bringing back the mind to focus on what are we trying to achieve through this process called life is itself referred to as anusmarana. This anusmarana can be practiced through this process of abhyasa. That's why he says abhyasa yoga yukta chetasa. The mind that has been trained through practice will help you lead, will help you achieve this instruction of sarvakaleshu mam anusmara yudhecha. We had also discussed this term anusmarana in detail. Anusmara actually means constant contemplation, and it also means the right way of contemplating on God. And both are applicable to the statement that Krishna is making in this chapter. Because in a sense, this chapter is about understanding God in the right light, right? Understanding that Supreme Brahman, understanding that He is the Adhyatma, He is the Adi Yajna, He is the Adi Bhuta, and He is the Adi Daiva, right? That's the whole idea. So anusmarana means to think of God in a way that He is ought to be thought about. Don't think of Him as some God who is waiting with a whip to punish you. That is also smarana. That is also thinking of God. But that is not anusmarana, because you are not thinking of God the way He actually is. And what is the way of thinking of Him as actually is? He is everything, right? That's what is anusmarana. So in the ninth verse, Krishna gives 8 phrases to contemplate upon as the true nature of God. And we also saw how most of these have been drawn from various Upanishads. This also means that the experience which led to some of these great sages to give these names and appellations for the Lord are being validated by Krishna in this particular verse. So what are those 8 verses that Krishna said you can contemplate upon, and that will be considered as anusmarana? Those 8 names are Kavim, the all-knowing one; Puranam, the ancient, the eternal one; Anushasitaram, the ordainer of all things; Anuraniyam, subtler than the subtlest; Sarvasya Dhataram, the basis, the Adhara of all beings; Achintya Rupam, one whose form is inconceivable; Aditya Varnam, the splendor of the sun as his complexion, which also means he is self-effulgent and all things become known because of his effulgence. That's why Aditya Varnam. Tamasap Parastat, the one beyond all darkness, who makes known even darkness. That is the meaning of the word, of the name Tamasap Parastat. So those are those eight words, and we also went through the meaning of each one of these terms as explained by Swami in the Gita Vahini. If any of you want to go back to that, it's in the 16th chapter of Gita Vahini. In the 10th shloka and the next few to follow, Krishna speaks about more specifics about the time of passing. And some of these descriptions are of yogic states. Krishna says that by the power of yoga and bhakti, the mind is controlled and the prana is placed in the middle of the two eyebrows. In the 11th, Krishna tells, he will speak of that state which the knower of Veda speaks about, the state those who have given up all attachment reach, aspiring for which brahmacharis practice brahmacharya. But we saw how a very similar shloka appears in the Upanishads, and when it appears in the Upanishad, it speaks about Omkara, right? If I'm not wrong, it's the Kathopanishad, and it's the dialogue between Nachiketa and Yama. So he uses the phrase Aksharam Padam, right? I will speak of that supreme state. But the word Padam also means word, right? Padam also stands for word in Sanskrit. So when he says Aksharam Padam, it means the supreme state. It also means the supreme word, which is Omkara. So Krishna goes on to further speak about the yogic way in which the body is given up. He says, Sarva Dwarani Samyamya, having controlled all gates or entrances, which means the senses, Mano Hridi Niruddhyacha, having the mind confined to the heart, which is the seat of the self, Moodni Adhaya Atmanaha Pranam Astitaha, having placed in the top of the head one's prana, Yoga Dharanam, through the practice of yoga. And then he continues in the 13th shloka, Om iti ekaksharam brahma, vyaharan mam anusmaran. Doing all this, one who meditates on the ekaksharam brahma Om and thinking of me, yaha prayati tyajan deham, who departs leaving the body, sa yati paramam gatim. He attains the supreme goal. Then we discussed about Om itself, the Pranava Mantra, in detail. And we also discussed what Swami says. You know, every pada, every word points to an object, which is a padartha. The word padartha also means that which gives meaning to a word. Pada plus artha is padartha. So that object which gives meaning to a pada is referred to as padartha. So for this pada, which is Om, which for this word Om, the padartha is Aksharam Brahma. So remembering Om in the last moments is nothing but remembering the Supreme Brahman as the only reality that is present everywhere. After having given such an overwhelming description in the 14th verse, Krishna then simplifies everything so beautifully. He says, it's almost like saying, forget about all of this. Don't get too carried away by these things. What you have to do is actually quite simple. What does he say in that 14th verse? He says, Ananya Chetaha Satatam Yomam Smarati Nityashaha, without any other thoughts. He who constantly thinks of me always. Tasya Nitya Yuktasya Yoginaha, for such an ever steadfast yogi, aham sulabaha, I am easy to attain. Such a beautiful assurance. I am easy to attain, aham sulabaha, if you are able to simply think of me and be immersed in love for me. Ananya chetaha satatam yomam smarati nityashaha. So after having spoken of all these complicated yogic ways of giving up the body, he says, don't trouble yourself with all these. Don't get carried away by all of these. All you have to do is only this. And if you do this, you most certainly will reach me. I become easy to attain. Not only you will reach me, but the whole process becomes so easy, he says. From the 15th verse, Krishna truly starts speaking of the state that is reached right, which he had said that he will explain about. He says that for such Mahatmas, the way he had described them, he refers to as Mahatmas, and he says, for such Mahatmas, Punarjanma Dukkhalayam Ashashvatam Na Apnuvanti. There is no return to this life of sorrow and impermanence. We then discussed in quite detail about why Krishna refers to life as Dukkhalayam, the abode of sorrow. And we also had a discussion about the Garbhopanishad, which speaks of how every jiva is born with the resolve to lead a spiritual life and not to be born again. But just the process of birth and life itself makes this memory be lost, leading one to get caught up in this endless cycle of birth and death. And that is why the one who is able to break from the cycle is glorified and is referred to as a Mahatma, a great being. From the 16th verse, Krishna goes on to speak of how supreme the status, even compared to the many glorious lokas that are mentioned in the scriptures that can be attained through effort, through yajnas and yagas. Even compared to all of these, what Krishna is speaking of here is extremely glorious in comparison. Krishna says, A Brahma Bhuvana Lokaha Punar Avartinaha Arjuna. The worlds where people exist, up to the world of Brahman, they are all bound to return. Through all your effort, you can go to these various higher realms of existence. You can go right up to the Brahma Loka, but you will have to return. Punar Avartinaha Arjuna. There is a condition that you will have to come back. The liberation that Krishna is speaking of, what the Mahatmas reach, is referred to as Kaivalya Mukti or Sadhya Mukti, absolute unity with the Supreme Spirit. Going to any other higher realm, eventually attaining liberation, step by step you raise yourself and attain, that Krishna speaks of in detail in the same chapter, comes under what is referred to as Karma Mukti. So when Krishna says there is return in every stage of this journey, it means that one should always have the vision fixed on that Supreme Brahman alone and not be carried away by the benefits one gets by reaching any of these greater lokas. Then we also discussed an important explanation or categorization that Swami speaks of in the Gita Vahini, which clearly explains some of the points that Krishna makes in the Gita. Swami had said that there are four pathways that people take in life, and each pathway takes one to a certain destination. So these are like four categories that all people can be divided into. The first category is karma tita, people who perform actions completely untouched by them. They are beyond and unaffected by the actions that happen through their body, right? It's a description of the jnani that we came across in the third chapter and the fourth chapter. Actions happen, but that person is unaffected by the consequences. So the first is karma tita. The second category is nishkama karma, actions without any desire for the results thereof, unaffected by any craving for the results that come from those actions. That is the second category, nishkama karma. The third is sakama karma, action with ambition to reap and enjoy the fruits. And the fourth category is karma bhrashta, actions that have no restraint, no control, people who perform actions without discriminating whether it is right or wrong. The first category are the jnanis, the second are the mumukshus, the spiritual aspirants, the third are good-natured worldly individuals, and the last category is that of those worldly people who have no sense of right and wrong. So the whole idea is to lift our actions from the lowest level, which is merely animal life, to the highest level, which is karma tita. If we belong to the third category of those who perform good karma, sakama karma, we must slowly practice nishkama karma. And as Swami said in the Gita Vahini, as per the practice and faith, the Lord will reward. And what is the reward? The reward is jnana. Eventually, as we saw in the earlier part, only jnana can remove grief, right? Nothing else can remove grief. So when one practices karma yoga the way it has to be practiced, as per one's practice and faith, the Lord will gift that jnana. In the 17th shloka of the chapter, Krishna gives a description of a day of Brahma. Very interesting section where he says that a day of Lord Brahma spans 1,000 Mahayugas and the night another 1,000 Mahayugas. One Mahayuga contains 4 Yugas, Krita, Treta, Dwapara and Kali. The duration of a Kali Yuga is 4,32,000 years. The Dwapara Yuga is 2 times the Kali Yuga duration. The Treta Yuga is 3 times that and Krita Yuga is 4 times that. So a Mahayuga is 10 times that of a Kali Yuga. So the period which consists of all 3 Yugas together, which is described as a Mahayuga, is 43,20,000 years. 1,000 such Mahayugas, which is 4,320,000,000 years, is just the daytime of Brahma. But why is Krishna mentioning this? What is it? How is it relevant to each one of us? He says that this entire creation is like the waking state of this Brahma. And when this day, which consists of 1,000 Mahayugas, comes to an end and he goes to sleep, this entire creation is withdrawn into himself, into what is referred to as the avyakta state. And when the next day begins, the same beings are then manifest in another cycle of creation. And even this Brahma, Krishna doesn't mention it in this part of the Gita, but the scriptures speak of this, Dadu Purana speak of this. This Brahma has a lifespan of 100 years. So even if one were to go up to the Brahma Loka, as Krishna said, and if one does not attain that merger with Brahman, there is going to be a return to cycle of birth and death. Of course, it might be after an enormously long period of time, but that long period of time is still not eternity. Krishna referred to Brahma's sleep as avyakta, right? In the 20th verse, Krishna clarifies that this is not the supreme avyakta. He says, paraha tasmat tu bhavaha anyaha avyaktaha avyaktat sanatanaha. But distinct from that unmanifested too is the other unmanifest, which is eternal. And yahasa sarveshu bhuteshu nashyatsu na vinashyati. And this one doesn't get dissolved when the whole of creation is dissolved. In the next verse, Krishna says, this avyakta is that akshara Brahman. And this is the paramam gatim, or the ultimate state that Krishna said that the person is trying to reach. And he further says that this is the state which when attained, there is no return, and that tad dhamam paramam mama. This place is my state. In the 22nd verse, Krishna says how the Supreme Purusha is attainable through one-pointed devotion. He says, purushah sa parah partha bhaktya labhyastva anyaya. In this life, the truth is, whatever we seek, we will find it. It may take some time to come to us, but it will definitely come to us if we have sought it. There may be some disappointments on the way, but we will eventually find what we seek. But there is a methodology to seek what we want, right? Be it success, be it money, be it fame, there is always a methodology. Similarly, if you seek some higher states of existence, some higher loka, that also can be attained. The methodology is spoken of in some of the scriptures, and that is why that is referred to as karma kanda. How can you, through your karmas, through the various rituals that you perform, reach higher places? Similarly, even God can be attained, but to attain God, also there is a methodology. And what is that methodology? What is that process? It is ananya bhakti. as Krishna had said in one of the previous verses, the mind that has been a yoga yukta ananya chetasa, right? The mind that has been trained by abhyasa to focus on nothing but the Lord. What is this ananya bhakti? I think we had a discussion on this based on the word gati that Krishna uses for supreme, the word gati that Krishna uses for supreme destination, paramam gatim, he had said, right? Gati is a word that has multiple meanings. Gati means state of being, so paramam gatim means that ultimate state beyond which there is none and reaching which there is no more growth, change or decline. Gati also means a point on a journey, and when we say paramam gatim, it means the destination, because the destination is the supreme point on any path of any journey. Gati also means the path itself. Gati also means the speed of moving on the path, and most importantly, gati also means refuge. And when we say param gati or paramam gati, it means the supreme refuge. So when a devotee goes through various ups and downs in life and finally realizes that God alone is the true and only refuge and says, Lord, your sharanam is my only gati. The Lord's shelter is my ultimate refuge. We refer to that as sharanagati. So when Krishna says, I can be reached only by ananya bhakti, it means this surrender where God becomes the destination, the goal, the aspiration and the refuge or companion through this journey. That is referred to as ananya bhakti, and where each one of life's endeavors is directed only towards God. That is what Krishna is referring to as ananya bhakti. That is what he spoke of also as anusmarana. He concludes that chapter with a crisp, that shloka with a crisp one sentence definition of this purusha. He says, Yasya antasthani bhutani, within whom all beings exist, yena sarvam idam tatam, by whom all this is pervaded. The last few verses of this chapter, from 23 to 28, Krishna speaks of the time that is considered auspicious to give up the body. It starts with Krishna saying, I will tell you about that time in which if the yogi starts the journey, there is return, and the time at which if he starts, there is no return. We discussed how this is related to the four categories of Swami that Swami had explained, karma tita, nishkama karma, sakama karma and karma bhrashta. The path of return is taken by those practicing sakama karma. The path of no return to the supreme state is taken by those practicing nishkama karma. The karma titas, of course, are liberated when alive. Then they are called jivan muktas. There is no journey for them after death. In the 24th verse, Krishna first speaks about the path of no return, and he says that those that have pursued Brahman or the spiritual goal reach Brahman following the path of fire, light, day, the bright fortnight or the waxing phase of the moon, the Uttarayana period or the period where the sun journeys northward in the sky. In the next verse, he speaks of the path of return, which is just the opposite of this. The individual follows the path of smoke, night, the waning fortnight and Dakshinayana, when the sun travels southwards in the sky. We also spoke of the inner significance of each one of these statements, right? According to the scriptures, there are three pathways after death that the jiva can take. They are Devayana, the path of the gods, Pitrayana, the path of the Pitrus or ancestors, and the pathways of sinners, which is sometimes is called as Adhoyana. The pathway of sinners is not discussed much in this part of the Gita. The first two, Devayana and Pitrayana, are discussed here. These two are also called, as we saw the various names, Uttarayana and Dakshinayana, Archiradi Marga and Dhumadi Marga. It is also referred to as Shukla Marga and Krishna Marga. Krishna explains, Krishna describes both these paths as being considered as eternal. Shukla Krishne Gatihi Ete Jagataha Shashvate Mate. Both of these are considered as being eternal in this world. And what is the significance of this? Because even in the path of return, it is a perpetual cycle. If one does not break away from it, one can be caught in it for eternity. When we say that the path of fire or path of smoke, we may think that it is a reference to cremation. It's a reference to what happens after death. But then Swami says that these are journeys that we in fact begin even when alive, because the body is undergoing decay and being burnt slowly even through life. But then we also spoke of the inner significance of these words, Dakshinayana, Uttarayana, Shukla Paksha and Krishna Paksha, where Swami gives the beautiful explanations or inner meanings. They also refer to the physical times, but they also have an inner meaning. The inner meaning is more important than the obvious or the straightforward external meaning. For one who chooses one path over the other, Krishna says that both these paths should be known. What happens if one takes both these paths? Because that's the thing he says in the next shloka. The one who has knowledge of both these paths will not be deluded. And that is the penultimate shloka of this particular chapter, where he says you should know where the Dakshinayana takes you. You should also know where the Uttarayana takes you. But at the same time, you should also know where Dakshinayana takes you. And you should take one path, dismissing the other. So one who knows clearly both these paths, Krishna says, will not be deluded, will not be confused. There will not be any lack of clarity in mind as to what one has to do or how one has to live one's life. Krishna concluded that penultimate shloka by advising Arjuna, Tasmat sarveshu kaleshu yoga yuktah bhava Arjuna. Therefore, at all times, be steadfast in yoga, O Arjuna. Knowing which path leads to freedom and which one to bondage is not enough. One must commit oneself to that path. Knowing the difference alone, there is only no delusion in the mind of what is right and what is wrong. But the ultimate delusion is removed only when one journeys on this path. That's why Krishna says, Yoga Yuktah Bhava Arjuna. The final shloka is a beautiful summary of this entire portion of the Gita. It is also an exhortation to look beyond the temptations in this world and the temptations of the other worlds or higher worlds too. But given in the form of a description of someone who has transcended all these temptations. Krishna says, Vedeshu Yagneshu Tapasu Chaiva Daneshu Yat Punya Phalam Pratishtam. All those results of righteous deeds that are declared with regards to the study of Vedas, sacrifices, austerities and also charities, Atyeti Tatya Sarvamidam Viditva Yogi. The yogi transcends all these benefits after knowing their worth in true. And such a yogi, he says, attains the supreme state, which is considered also the primordial state. I concluded last week with a quote from the Gita Vaini, and I'll do the same today as well. Swami had said there is no need to doubt whether such a stage is within the reach of all, whether all can achieve this victory or not. Nor is any special effort or peculiar good fortune or specially designed act necessary. When we go through all this, two points are very clear. One, this is not an ordinary goal. This is not an ordinary pathway. This is not an ordinary adventure that we are setting up for ourselves. As Swami had said in the Gita Vaini, we must not consider this as some cheap goal. Only when we know its real worth, we will be prepared to put in the efforts that is necessary. But at the same time, Swami says that we must not think that this is unreachable. We should not have the doubt whether such a stage is within our reach. As Swami had said in one of the Samukos discourses, Swami said that you should tell yourself that people like you, individuals like you, have become great Mahatmas and reached the goal. why can't you reach the goal? That should be what we have to tell ourselves. So that, dear listeners, was the 8th chapter. And with that, we also complete the summary of the 8th chapter. And we will have to begin the 9th chapter from the next episode. So I thank you all for your very patient listening. I most humbly offer this effort of the summary of this entire chapter at Swami's lotus feet. And I pray on behalf of all of you and myself that Swami ensures that whatever we have gone through does not remain in the realm of knowledge or data or mere intellectual understanding. Let it become part of our experience. Let it become part of our life. Let it become part of our abhyasa or practice. With that, I take leave of you, dear listeners. In a short while from now, you'll be joined by Brother Bishu for the next segment. I will join you again at 12 for the afternoon satsang. But till I meet you next time for the Gita series, A Triune Pilgrimage, take care, keep safe, Jai Sai Ram.